At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Come on, seriously? An almost 1,000-point rise on the Dow in one day? After last week? Maybe they really figured out how to fix this thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist, presenting a major report from around the world on the global economic crisis, the panic, the rescues, and what's next, at newsstands and economist.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 13th of October. Good to have you with us. We continue with fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis, and there is a temptation here to channel Alfred E. Newman, that gap-toothed character from Mad Magazine, and say, just like he did, what? Me worry? A quick glance at the Dow today explains everything, but it does leave out those pesky details, like what exactly the Treasury Department has in mind with its new bank recapitalization plan. Henry Paulson convened a meeting today at the White House with the people running some of those banks. We'll get a sense of what went on. And the Fed is feeling extra generous. Why its latest move might actually work. Neel Kashkari gave a speech this morning to the Institute of International Bankers. He's the guy running the Treasury Department's bailout program, which explains why his remarks matter.
Our goal is to use the multiple tools enabled by the TARP to attack the capital and troubled asset problem from multiple directions so that American families and businesses can get the credit that they need.
A quick translation here. TARP is the Troubled Asset Relief Program, one of the names for the original bailout package. And multiple tools means the package has changed a bit since the president signed it. As we told you Friday, it's now going to have the government taking a stake in the banks it helps out. The CEOs of some of those banks made a trip down to Washington today for a tete-a-tete at the White House, in theory, to work out the details. Economist Robert Lighton's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Lighton, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at that meeting this afternoon at the White House with Secretary Paulson and these big bankers. Is there a chance that they're going to look at him either one-on-one or in the conference room and say, Hank, what took you so long?
Yeah, they could say that. And it'll probably be a can of conversation about what else Treasury ought to be doing. There'll probably be questions about the recapitalization details that were not provided by Assistant Secretary Kashkari today, perhaps outlook for the general economy, and so on.
What's your guess as to the details of that recapitalization plan? How's that going to work?
Well, we're still all somewhat in the dark. I'm reasonably certain we know that it's going to be voluntary. We don't know whether the stock is going to be voting or non-voting that the Treasury is going to purchase, which is a big philosophical issue. Over in Europe, the bailout there is having the government take voting positions and, in fact, controlling positions in the banks. I don't think we'll do that here in the United States, or at least I hope not. Then there'll be the issue of price.
So price, once again, is a problem. Either it's the stock price at which we would recapitalize these banks, or it's the price of the troubled assets that we would take as part of the original bailout.
Price is always a big deal. It's going to be easier to do a price, I think, on the recapitalization if you pick a date, because at least there is a market price for the publicly traded stocks. It's much more difficult, of course, to determine price for the troubled assets. Mm-hmm. You can do an auction for if perhaps some of them But I suspect you're going to have to do a lot of one-on-one negotiations for the assets.
Play out for me a moment the issue of whether or not we should have a voting share in these banks. Taxpayers will say, listen, we're paying good money. We want to say in how these banks are run, because clearly they weren't doing such a good job before.
Well, that's certainly a good argument to have a voting position. On the other hand, I think it's somewhat awkward in what remains of our capitalist system to have the government be running a good portion of the banking system, or even a significant minority of the banking system. The government is not a banker.
Is this now finally going to work? Why is recapitalization better than the original bailout?
Well, if it's done in a formulaic way where the price is sort of a formula, namely a price on a particular day, I think the recap can go much more quickly than the asset sales. And since the core problem here is that the banks don't trust each other, they don't know if their counterparty is going to be solvent the next day, it's imperative that Treasury get in there in some way and assure the banks that the other banks they're dealing with are still going to be around. And if you can do the recap more quickly than the asset purchase, then by all means do it.
Obviously, nothing's without risk at this level of finance. Do you worry about private investors staying away now that the government's in there?
It's true that for any individual bank, when the government makes a purchase, it dilutes the ownership rights of the existing shareholders. But on the other hand, for shareholders as a whole, for all banks, if they know that the government's not going to let a bunch of them go down, that seems to me to be a confidence-enhancing move, which should actually strengthen bank capital shares as a group.
Robert Leighton is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Economics. Mr. Leighton, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.
After almost a year of a couple of $100 billion here and a couple of $100 billion there trying to unstick the credit markets, we now know exactly how far the Federal Reserve is going to go to fend off financial disaster. Apparently, sky's the limit. Our own central bank is now offering to loan its European counterparts an unlimited flow of dollars. Unlimited as in actually unlimited. The Fed made an announcement this morning along with the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and the Swiss National Bank. But they promise it's not some kind of colossal handout, as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
So how much do you need? Uncle Sam has all the crisp bills you can use. Banks here in this country have been hearing that for months now, but there may be a bigger problem developing with the flow of greenbacks outside our borders. So the Fed is agreeing to swap as many dollars as necessary for euros and British pounds. It's not that there's not enough money to go around over there. It's just that the dollar is still the international currency of choice. Mark Sunshine heads the financial services firm First Capital.
Companies in the eurozone buy and sell and trade certain commodities like oil in dollars. Another example would be when Boeing wants to sell an airplane or airplane parts. Right now, those European airlines can't get enough dollars to literally be able to buy an airplane.
The promise of an unlimited supply of greenbacks was clearly welcomed on global markets today. Sunshine says it's about time the rescue operation started focusing on Europe.
The European Central Bank, as well as European government leaders, have sort of been hiding under a rock and hoping that the financial services crisis was really an American phenomenon and didn't apply to them. And very drastic sort of catch-up action is needed.
At Global Insight, Chief Economist Nariman Verovich says this isn't free money. Borrowers will have to put up collateral. And he says unlimited doesn't necessarily mean permanent.
Everybody understands these are temporary kind of provisions and that at some point the Fed will take the money back when it's no longer needed, when the panic has subsided, if you will.
For now, though, Verovich says the move should help make up for the hoarding of dollars overseas by both banks and investors. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Speaking of overseas, after a weekend's worth of meetings, France, England, and Germany, as well as some other European countries, have unveiled their fix for what ails the credit markets. Turns out it's cash and cash and a little more cash pumped directly into banks. And the markets finally found a rescue they could love. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the European plan.
The British government pledged $63 billion. France, $480 billion. Germany took the cake with $670 billion. Such vast sums of money are almost old hat these days, but the overwhelmingly positive reaction from the markets was new.
I would say that we have turned the corner here, yes.
Julian Callow is chief European economist for Barclays Capital. He says Europe's united effort was key to restoring confidence in the markets.
If it's just one country going it alone or a couple of countries, the markets are going to think that that isn't going to be sufficient. But when you have most of the G7. I think that really does send a very powerful signal.
The government plans are all variations on the same theme, getting money to banks in every possible way and taking the risks out of intrabank transactions. That means guaranteeing loans between banks, insuring deposits, and buying up big chunks of stock in financial institutions. Wharton School economist Ken Thomas says this is the only way to turn things around.
The real problem here is loss of confidence. We rebuild confidence by having such a huge amount of money in the trillions on a global basis that we are basically saying the banks are too big to fail. We're going to back them all up.
Thomas says unlike past plans, things like lowering interest rates and bailing out individual companies, this strategy gets at the heart of the problem. He says it will probably take years to recover from the financial crisis, but in general, we're on the right track. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Today is Columbus Day, which ordinarily would pass unmentioned on this broadcast, save for this. While the equity markets were open, the bond markets were closed, which means there was one less place for investors to put their money today. So maybe those double-digit percentage gains on Wall Street were just a tad artificially exuberant. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's something to bear in mind as you consider the 936-point ride the Dow took us on today. If you're one of those who's worried about market volatility, those triple-digit swings we've been seeing for what seems like forever now, then you need to know that up can be as bad as down, and a 936-point gain can be as troubling and as irrational as a 777-point drop. Is there a reason stocks that dropped 40% last week are up 20% today? Is today all of a sudden a better time to invest in everything from banks to fast food? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now on the science of volatility.
To help illustrate volatility, I've asked my father, Ian Hobson, who is a pianist, to play what the market sounds like when things are relatively calm. Now, last week was anything but calm. United Health Group, for instance, had a terrible time. Dad?
Jeremy, I'm going to play United Health October Surprise, first movement.
That's a 30% loss in the course of the week. Then there was today, up 30%. Now that's volatility. Lawrence White is an economist at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says when fear kicks in, investors may ignore a company's fundamentals and take on a herd mentality.
A few people say, well, gosh, those people are selling. They must know something. And that's when you get this kind of snowballing, high volatility kind of events.
It works both ways, of course. Investors often chase a stock up the market if it appears hot. But White says this kind of volatility is reminiscent of the 1929 and 87 crashes.
What is exceptional, I think, is the length of time that we've experienced high volatility this time around.
And it continued today. Just wait till you hear the numbers. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The presidential debate later this week is going to focus on domestic policy, so it's fair to assume we'll hear a good deal about the economy and the two candidates' proposed fixes for it. Of course, the financial crisis has implications for everybody, including the environmentally minded electorate. In today's installment of our election series, Interested Parties, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explores what green voters want from the government next time around.
Toilet paper as a sustainability issue, I could sort of imagine, 100% recycled or virgin. But toilet paper, yes or no, that I didn't anticipate until I met some of the organizers of EnviroMom.com.
We had a mom at one point who was trying not to use toilet paper.
Christy Kaczynski read about this mom on the website. Christy has a 5-year-old and does environmental planning for small businesses.
Not many people want to go there, and so it's great to hear that she was making the effort.
Has anyone else tried that?
No.
No.
No way.
These women are eager to push the envelope in other ways, from promoting bike commuting to buying renewable energy. They meet to talk at a suburban community center from time to time about their problems trying to go more green. Heather Hawkins is co-founder of the website and a stay-at-home mother of two.
We want to get people talking, and we want to get people thinking about the choices that they're making in their lives, about the products that they're buying, what impact the creation and transport of those products are having on the environment.
Jen Blattner is a community organizer on conservation issues. She believes in a combination of forceful environmental regulations and personal action, and she is convinced the sweeping changes needed to save the planet for her young son will come from the bottom up.
Our conversations really go beyond the political. You know, there's only so much that politicians can do, and then the rest is up to us.
Which is just the sentiment I expected to hear when I went to see Carla Chambers. She's the outspokenly pro-business owner of Staubach Island Farms.
We grow and process over 16 fruits and vegetables. We're probably best known for our pumpkin and squash, our butternut squash, our super sweet corn.
Chambers is a fourth-generation farmer, and she's raising 5,000 acres of certified organic and sustainable row crops. She believes in limited government.
I like to see government take on a role where they can help incentivize direction and change, but not be the primary driver. I don't view government as the primary driver of the economy or job creation. That should be left to the private sector.
Chambers likes government policies that provide a framework for business and consumers, like the FDA's organic standards and country of origin labeling. They've sure helped her business grow. But she's skeptical of any heavy-handed federal intervention that picks winners or losers, like the government's promotion of corn ethanol, which she says has taken a chunk of farmland the size of Iowa out of food production.
I think sustainability, especially in our natural resource sector, is really a national security issue, and we should be thinking of it much the way we're thinking about our dependency on foreign oil. We need to really be thoughtful about our food supply.
From Carla Chambers' bustling farm, I can draw a direct line to this natural food store where I met Kim Gordon. A few aisles down, cans of Staubach Island Farms pumpkin pie puree were stacked on the shelves. Gordon, an environmental designer, was shopping with her husband and little baby. She's a transplant to Oregon from Alabama.
You know, we are avid composters, avid recyclers, avid environmentalist in general. That's probably the most important issue for me.
Gordon says she wants the next administration to do everything it can to convert the economy to renewable energy and legalize industrial hemp production. She says creating a path to a sustainable future in the long term means implementing sweeping changes now while there's still time. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, putting your faith in the stock market.
People, I find it amazing that it would close 777 points down today, the biblical numbers of perfect completion. I pray we are out of here soon.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, how to explain a gain of 936 points for the Dow today? The Blue Chip Index roared back by more than 11%, closing at 9,387. The NASDAQ reclaimed 194 points for a gain of 11.8% to finish at 1844. The S&P 500 rebounded by 104 points, more than 11.5% to wrap up the trading day at 1,003. You'd almost never know we were in the grip of a financial crisis, given the giddy performance of financial shares today. Mitsubishi Financial completed its $9 billion investment in Morgan Stanley, propelling that stock skyward 87%. Shares in Goldman Sachs jumped 25%. Wachovia stock rebounded more than 13% after the Fed approved its takeover by Wells Fargo. Crude oil rose more than $3 to $81 a barrel. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. want more from Marketplace's special coverage on the fallout from America's financial crisis? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, staff blogs, and an interactive map of our road trip across the country. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The President's Advisory Council on Financial Literacy meets. The American Petroleum Institute gives a forecast of oil and natural gas policy concerns for the next administration. And on this day in 1926, the chubby little cubby all stuffed with fluff, Winnie the Pooh, was first published. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Leaders of the big industrialized countries had a busy weekend trying to figure out a way to save the economies of the big industrialized countries. Financial shenanigans in those economies got us into this mess, so they should have to get us out. And you don't have to work too hard to see that the damage to the developed economic world could be pretty bad. But commentator and economist Edward Miguel says the world's poorest countries are likely to be hit much harder.
We're all glued to Wall Street's implosion, and for good reason. We're worried about falling home values in our 401ks. The crisis will also hit the world's poorest people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, who are least able to buffer the shock. For one, in the recent vice presidential debate, Joe Biden said that one consequence of the financial crisis would be a cut in U.S. foreign aid. That's not good for countries like many in Africa that rely on bilateral aid for a large chunk of their national budget to make sure their civil servants, police, and judges keep getting paid. As American wallets snap shut, charities will also take a hit. We Americans are incredibly generous givers to the developing world, funding everything from primary schools to maternal and child health clinics to microcredit for rural entrepreneurs. Many of these worthwhile projects will wither when assistance from overseas dries up. The volatility in financial markets has also dragged down many commodity prices from historic highs. While some consumers will gain from these falling prices, agricultural producers in the world's poorest countries suffer a major blow when the price of their main export crop plummets. Think of coffee producers in poor places like Guatemala, Vietnam, or Rwanda. When the price of coffee suddenly falls 50%, their income is effectively cut in half. A halved income would shock most Americans, but it's the difference between life and death for a small farmer living on a few dollars per day. A recession in latte-addicted countries like the U.S. will push down demand for coffee even more. The loss of income could heighten social instability, political violence, and mass migration in developing countries. Our unfolding financial crisis may lead to the most severe downturn we've seen in years. I only hope that we Americans and our leaders don't forget that its consequences are likely to be much worse for the world's poorest countries when deciding how much to donate to charity and whether to fund a generous foreign aid budget this year.
Edward Miguel teaches economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called Economic Gangsters: Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations. Share your thoughts with us when you get a chance. Go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. There are a couple of phrases that have been thrown around pretty freely over the past couple of weeks. Crash, of course. Recession, sometimes. Financial Armageddon's another popular one. It's a biblical reference, of course. Armageddon is where Jesus and the Antichrist battle it out at the end of the world. It's an actual place, in fact. And as it turns out, Scripture says financial Armageddon and Armageddon Armageddon might be related. Then again, they might not be, as Marketplace's Sean Cole explains.
When the financial crisis really started to take hold, I got to thinking what I often think in times of crisis, that people who already believe the world is coming to an end must be feeling pretty vindicated right now. So I went to this website called Rapture Forums to check out some of the discussions. This was right after the House voted down the first bailout bill and the Dow tanked. Here are some excerpts.
People, I find it amazing that it would close 777 points down today, the biblical numbers of perfect completion. I pray we are out of here soon.
I say, praise God. Bring it on.
I second your statement to praise God. All this is just bringing us closer to being with Him.
The rapture, if you're not familiar, is when all of Christ's followers ascend to heaven. This is supposed to happen before, or after, depending on who you ask, a 7-year period of great tribulation. The Antichrist enslaves humanity, all sorts of awful things happen. That's a long way off yet, but supposedly we've already entered what's known as the end times. So I thought I should talk to a couple of guys who specialize in what you might call end times economics.
I believe that the fact that the Dow was down 777 points on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, it didn't happen by coincidence.
Norm Franz is the author of Money and Wealth in the New Millennium. He writes and preaches a lot about the end times from a financial perspective. He says Rosh Hashanah is all about judgment. And 2 Mondays ago, God brought the gavel down.
He's saying that this world's financial system is built upon an unrighteous foundation.
So it was God speaking to the earth through the stock market.
Yes, it was God speaking to the nations that what you're doing is not according to my ways, and this is the consequence of your ways.
But in general, and in this one case, not all end-timers agree on the specifics.
It would be difficult to just say that, you know, that is a divine intervention in the Dow Jones.
Wilfred Hahn is the CIO of a wealth management company in British Columbia.
Although I believe God, you know, does have a sense of humor, and he's not above... is not above dropping a few hints.
He also publishes the Eternal Values Review, a bi-monthly newsletter about biblical prophecy and money. To him, the crisis is certainly a sign of the times.
Well, sign of the times is very different than meaning prophecy is being fulfilled. But the Bible does lay out some clear conditions and events and developments that will happen inside of the tribulation period, and very certainly that will involve financial collapses.
Paradoxically, though, the tribulation is also supposed to involve a unified global economy with a common currency. You might think all of this is crazy, but it's not something these folks made up. It's biblical interpretation. Revelation 13, for instance, says no one would be able to buy or sell unless they had the mark of the beast, meaning the Antichrist. Some folks take that to mean we'll all eventually have teeny scannable credit cards implanted in our skin. And some folks, thus, think that kind of technology is evil. But Wilfred Hahn says it's only the Antichrist that's evil.
That individual and groups of individuals working with him will just use the systems that are available to them at that point in time for evil purpose.
I see. So it's not one world economy per se that's bad, but a bad dude.
But we're dealing here with human matters of the heart. What do we worship? Do we worship this late model car that we so love? It being a product of great technology or anything else. So I think, you know, that's the point we have to really differentiate here, is where are our hearts and our beliefs.
In other words, technology is fine as long as it doesn't take the place of God. And whether you are a believer or not, maybe now is a good time to ask ourselves what we worship. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it is properly the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, but today it comes with a little bit of a political subtext. Princeton economist, New York Times columnist, and rigorous critic of the Bush administration, Paul Krugman, won the prize this morning. $1.4 million and a gold medal for, as the citation says, his analysis of trade patterns and location of economic activity, which is to say, how trade develops and what gets made where. And that is Marketplace. We get made by American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 936 points. I'll say that again, 936 points, 11%. The Nasdaq soared 194 points, 11.8%. The S&P 500 packed on 104 points. That's 11.5% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Fallout continues tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. Snake handlers and voiceover artists cope with these uncertain times.
Being self-employed in such oddball fields as we've chosen, it's always a crapshoot.
And here on Marketplace, Russian oligarchs score a few points in the world of English football. That and the latest from Washington and Wall Street. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.